and 99% transparent. Very similar to the Con Ed wiring across the street from you. Even though it's the same altitude as your dipole, you think it's going to give you a great big blockage in that direction. Absolutely not. As long as it's not resonant, it's transparent. Over to you, John. Correction to Joe. At the BQ HRO, KQIW in the TechNet. Come back and let us know how these antenna experiments go, Joe.
I will do that. I'll do that because I'll keep you informed how we get. So the next project will be to probably put up a long wire in another direction. The one that's following the roof will be left there, and I'm going to have to figure out a stepping relay to switch from one to the other. That's what I want to do. That's the next thing. And back to you.
Yeah, those are fun experiments, Joe. The cost of the raw materials is not very high. The performance you get out of it is not thoroughly predictable. Some of it will be pleasant surprises. Some of it will be unpleasant surprises. It's a big learning experience. So I think City College should have an awful lot of wire in the air around it, doing all of this radiation capability and all these experiments. And with a switching arrangement where you're listening to a guy in London, you switch between antenna A, B, and C on different days at different hours, you see different kinds of response. To make antennas that have difference in polarization is worthwhile, because that signal on the HF frequencies that gets to you from London, that's been through that ionosphere, we keep forgetting about the fact that the ionosphere is an ionized material with it's a plasma with a local magnetic field from the Earth mixed into it, which means it has gyrotropic properties. Fancy word of saying that it will twist the polarization. That vertically polarized signal radiated by your buddy in London probably twists 3 or 4 times going through that ionosphere before it arrives in New York City, where now it's a horizontally polarized signal at this hour of this particular day for the state of the ionosphere. So the word polarization on long-range signals has got a peculiar meaning. So any means by which you can flip from antenna A to B during this half hour to favor that particular polarization is going to get rid of some of that QSB. And look out for the fact that, let me drop, this polarization shifting effect due to gyrotropy, which is called the Faraday rotation effect, because I think Mr. Faraday is the first guy who recognized the physics of it. It does not obey reciprocity. In other words, the number of twists you get for the signal going from east to west, the number of twists you get for the signal from going west to east, are not the same. Your guy in London may transmit a signal to you vertical, and today you hear it best horizontal. With a little bit of experiment, you may find out that if you radiate vertical to him, back in the other direction, he's going to hear the strongest signal for vertical in his location. It violates reciprocity. It's a really crazy phenomenon, Faraday rotation. A lot of us forget about it. An awful lot of the QSB fade you hear on any of these HF frequencies, you think the signal is hopping over you. In some cases, it's just twisting in polarization, and your antenna is not responding to it. The more wire you hang up there, the more you'll have the ability to switch between these antennas and test for these properties, Joe. Good experiment. Okay, let me drop for a second. Now, the next person on the list is Rich, N2EO. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, we wanted to say we are using it. Thank you for putting up here. People know, but maybe some haven't. It's coming from you where you'll be 2 years and a half, my right way. A diabetic. That's what happened. Appreciate to you guys stopping by, giving me a hand. Anyway, Dick, I have a question.
Yeah, that's a very high quality of nylon rope. And nylon rope in the ultraviolet exposure, at least 5 years, maybe 10 years before it starts turning into a powder and becomes depolymerized. You've got at least 5 years on that rope, and maybe 10. And what we did, Barry and I hooked up an eye bolt into the, let's call it the southern tree and the northern tree. We hooked an eye bolt in there and strung the rope through the ran the rope down the tree, another 20 or 30 feet, and tied it to another eye bolt lower on the tree. By doing that, by having an extra length of the nylon rope on the north side of your antenna and the south side of your antenna, and the fact that nylon is a springy material, means that you've got a kind of spring. As those trees sway back and forth, the stretch of that extra length of rope going down the tree, use upper eye bolt as a pulley, means that you can accommodate the trees swaying independently and not breaking the antenna. So we think that structure is going to last for you quite a while. If not, we know somebody who can repair it. I did something a little bit unfair to Rich last Monday. Let me drop. I knew Barry's going to be there installing the antenna. I knew Barry would need some extra tools and silkastic adhesive and whatever that I had. So I showed up, didn't tell anybody that I was coming. And so since Rich hasn't seen me for about 4 or 5 years face to face, he didn't remember what I looked like. But I went there incognito and had some fun with him, telling him that I'm Barry's assistant without announcing who I was. But he eventually figured it out. So looks like you got a good installation there on this. And when we eventually hook up that 450 ohm ladder line to your antenna tuner, Allen antenna tuner, which I think needs some repair, and I think Barry's got another one. And when it comes to repairing an antenna tuner, antenna tuner balance structure, I'm having trouble believing that there's something in there that's so magic that it has to be sent back to the factory. I think that can be repaired, because if you arc over a capacitor, you can file down the... Let me drop. An air variable capacitor that gets arced over because somebody put 2 kilowatts to it, you can easily file down the bumps, so to speak, or if the roller inductor is not making good contact, there's ways of cleaning up the silver plating. It's almost, to damage an antenna tuner, balance antenna tuner, is quite difficult. So I think it's repairable. I don't think it's got to go back to the factory. Maybe you and Barry have discussed that further. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
There's DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
For the beep. Yeah, as long as you have an antenna analyzer, you shove it into the antenna tuner input. You can use a pot even, 1,000 ohm pot set for 500-600 ohms, or any impedance you want, and see if the thing balances on the analyzer. It's pretty easy to troubleshoot. It shouldn't have to go back to a manufacturer. It's pure simple textbook.
That's good information, Hal. And Hal, you were referred to earlier. It turns out that a guy named John, KD2 India X-Ray Papa, is looking for an instruction sheet of a particular antenna that was manufactured 20 or so years ago. It's called the Antenna Specialist Monitor Antenna, Antenna Specialist Monitor 56. Is there a slim chance that in your vast files that you've got a data sheet on that particular antenna, Hal? K6DPZ, mobile, K2RIW.
Sure, but I'll tell you what he should have. It's a very big file on all these antennas. K2UU, what he may have in that piece.
Okay, I thought you had a bigger file on past antennas than Woody, but we'll check with Woody, K2UU, who now lives in Dix Hills, the same town that I live in. And I visited him, he's got quite an installation. Okay. So you're not sure whether or not you've got a antenna specialist monitor 56 data sheet. So keep that in mind. So I think that antenna tuner probably doesn't have to go back to the factory. I mean, what do we know is wrong with it, Rich, and why do you think it would be difficult to repair? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, that rotary switch, that sounds like a rather specialized item. But maybe by way of extra toggle switches that could be installed in the front panel. You could re-establish that thing without the rotary switch. Let's see what Hal's got to say on that one. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, KQRIW.
He said Barry replaced the switch, Dick.
Go ahead, Hal.
I offered Rich a Johnson matchbox that's at least has a balanced output matchbox. The 250-watt box will handle a KWPEP. He's welcome to borrow it, and you know, at least he'll have something for now to get on the air.
Yeah, that's an attractive offer, and I think you should take him up on that. The price is right for the time being. Okay. I think we're going down the list of everybody who signed in. It's time to go over to the mailbag. And we're almost on time with the mailbag tonight, John. And go easy with us. I know that some of these guys, they're working on their master's degrees, and sometimes they ask you their homework questions. Sometimes they give us a tough time. WB2WGB. AC2WGB. I'll eventually get your call letters. K2RIW. Over to you, John.
AC2WGB. Yeah, I forget a microphone sometimes. All right. I've wanted his first question. Yeah, we have no test takers today, I think. I have a gentleman here who's, he knows you have a lot of knowledge about the space program, and when they made the trip to the moon, and they were communicating from Houston to the moon, his question is, how did they couple back the signal from the different receiving stations to Houston, and were they doing simplex or duplex? If you know, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I was listening to those signals live, both the uplink and the downlink. The uplink was 2106.4 megahertz. 2106.4 was the uplink. 2287.5 was the downlink of the command service module of all of the Apollo 11 through 17 spacecraft. And that was full duplex. The signal from Houston went by satellite to each of the other ground stations. Ground station was in the Mojave Desert of Goldstone, California, right inside of Fort Irwin. And I was there once as a visit. Another one of the ground stations was in Spain. These are all 140-foot diameter parabolic dishes. And the third one is in Honeysuckle Creek, Australia. What's nice about those three locations is they're roughly 120 degrees different in longitude. So as the Earth rotates, at least one of those dishes at all times is within view of either the satellite or the moon, so to speak. So by geosynchronous satellites, you transmit the signal with the commands and so on it from Houston to those ground stations and back. And I can tell you the reason I can say that it was full duplex is that the uplink signal, 2106.4, was received by the spacecraft, and the receiver would phase lock itself to that signal. So as a signal, you could literally take the transmitter and move it a few megacycles higher or lower, and the receiver on board the spacecraft would follow you. And the Australians did just that during the Apollo 13 mission, because they were using the lunar module simultaneous with the repeater.
Time out.
Because of the failure they had during Apollo 13, they were using, the astronauts were huddled inside of the lunar module using its power supply and saving the batteries on the command module because they knew they were going to need them during the reentry sequence. But unfortunately, those two transmitters were essentially on the same frequency. And so what the Australians did was to practice ahead of time and found out that they could slowly pull the receiver for the command module off frequency and leave the lunar module as is, or pull one up and pull the other one down so you could talk to both spacecraft simultaneously. I think two of the astronauts were inside of the lunar module and one of the astronauts was in the command module during most of that Apollo 13 repair mission. Reconfigured mission, so to speak, where they looped around the moon and didn't land, of course, and came right straight back as fast as they could. So the uplink frequency has FM modulation with audio from the ground station to the astronauts. Let me drop. The the receiver on the spacecraft locks to that frequency, it transmits audio back down on a subcarrier. The audio subcarrier for the astronauts was 1.25 megacycles. So you had an FM modulated, actually a phase modulated, you had a phase modulated subcarrier on the downlink, and the subcarrier at 1.25 megacycles contained astronaut audio. The phase locked, the subcarrier at 1 megacycle contained telemetry data, battery voltages and temperatures and things like that. So you had a bunch of channels of downlink information, which is independent of the uplink information and audio. And so although there's only one receiver and one transmitter on board in operation at that time, the system with that configuration was full duplex. Wonder if that makes some sense. By the way, I was able to hear both the uplink and the downlink. Let me drop.
I'm at K6DVZ.
Go ahead, Al.
Phase talk or EFC they were using?
Something they were using. Speak a little bit slower. Squeeze the mic. Wait a second. Then talk. Talk a little slower. And give me the full question. I'm not getting it. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, was that phase lock or was it AFC on the receiver locking to the transmitter?
I think it's phase lock. Not positive. In either case, if you've got freak lock or phase, if you've got high enough on the freak lock, it becomes academic as to which it really. So it was phase modulated. Phase modulated.
You're being clobbered.
I'm hearing it. Phase locked subcarriers that were giving us the uplink and the downlink. So the phase modulated subcarriers were differentiating the telemetry data from the audio data on both the uplink and the downlink. So with that very elaborate system, it really was full duplex at all times. I was able to hear both the uplink and the downlink by two separate methods. I discovered that the uplink that was on something like 75 KC subcarrier, uplink audio, a little bit of that was being retransmitted into the downlink. So if I listened to the subcarrier at 75 KC, I could hear uplink audio. If I listened to the subcarrier, the intended downlink subcarrier, at 1.25 megs, I could hear astronaut downlink audio. Also, during the time that the command module was in front of the moon, and Goldstone is aimed directly at the moon, aimed at that spacecraft, I could also hear the uplink by listening to 2106.4 megahertz. I could hear the uplink by way of moon bounce. And to listen to FM modulated signals off the moon by moon bounce from a really potent 240-foot diameter dish in Goldstone, exciting stuff to listen to. It had a little bit of flutter in there, but good clean audio, if you know what I mean. A very fun project, as you can tell. KC2WGB, K2I. By the way, I did that on both Apollo 15 and Apollo 16, and did it with borrowed equipment from Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And you can read about this. Let me drop. You can see pictures of the equipment we used: a homebrew 12-foot diameter dish, homebrew feed horn on that antenna, carefully tuned to 2.3 gigahertz. You can see pictures of that by looking at the dish in the August issue, 1972 QST magazine. That's the 12-foot stress parabolic dish article. And there's an article in the June issue called Houston, This is Apollo, by W4HHK and K2RIW. That'll show you the schematic diagram of how we set up the equipment, as well as more pictures of what we actually did. So there's at least two QST articles on this. One other interesting thing is that when you do a Google search by Wikipedia as to the confirmations that that the Apollo program landing on the moon was not a hoax, that it really was taking place. Let me drop. Google and Wikipedia will tell you that the K2RIW operation to listen to the astronauts off the moon is one of the confirmations that the Apollo program was real. It wasn't a California hoax. It wasn't a Hollywood hoax, if you know what I mean. Because in order for them to hoax me, they would have had to have just the right frequencies, just the right Doppler shift, and just the right directions that I was aiming the antenna toward the moon at just the right time. My goodness. It would have taken them $1 billion worth of hardware just to continue to fool me if that was all a hoax. So, as I said, I'm quoted as one of the pieces of evidence that it really did take place. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2 WGB. Yeah, most of us do believe that we were there. There's a few diehards out there that are going to hold on, Dick. Good information. At least he has a place to go to read about it, which is good. And maybe he'll try that. That might help him out. Okay, let me let it drop. I'm going for the next question. They have a young amateur with a couple of receivers, and male illumination is performed by number 47 pilot lamps. They're, I think, 6.3 volts, something like that. He wants to replace them with LEDs. How would he go about that? Now, he already measured, he knows that they're fed with a DC voltage. They're not fed with AC, so they should be compatible with LEDs without too much of an effort. But he doesn't know what to do. He has about 6 or 7 LEDs, all white, and he has a few to experiment with. If he blows them, he's not worried about it. But how should he proceed, and what should he do first to determine whether he can make this work? Back to you, Dick. KC2 WGB.
DB0 to comment.
Go ahead, Hal. Bet you've done that already.
Now, DC going to those 47 bulbs, or is it AC? That's my first question.
I said DC, Hal. It is DC, 6.3.
Okay, very easy. You use silicon diodes in series with the LED. 3 or 4 of them. Each silicon diode has 0.7 volts drop. And he has the way of dropping the voltage to the LED, and you don't have to use resistors. It's very cheap and dirty. K6DB7.
Yeah, that's one way of doing it, and this is one of those cases where Hal and I have got a slight difference in philosophy. You choose the right series dropping resistor that drops the 6.3 volts down to the approximately 1.5 volts that the light-emitting diode works on. And once you look at the data sheet on your light-emitting diode, it may tell you, it gives you full brilliance at, I'm going to pick a number, 30 milliamps. So for you to calculate the right resistor to drop 6.3 volts down to 1.5 volts with 30 milliamps of flowing through it, that's a very simple calculation. I prefer the resistor approach because it's got a hell of a lot more safety in it. If the 6.3 volts went up to 7.5 volts or down to 5 volts because the power line is up or down and whatever, or because the real voltage being delivered is different than the manufacturer said, the resistor could easily accommodate that. It would be a very minor difference in illumination. When you use diode dropping, you're getting a rather kind of exact voltage drop, so that with minor variation in voltage supply, you're either going to be overpowering the light-emitting diode or underpowering it. So the diode dropping approach is an approach. It works. I think the resistor approach is safer. I wonder why you were against the resistor approach, Hal, because it doesn't make a difference in overall efficiency. You're dropping the same amount of voltage at the same amount of current, but it takes a lot more components to do it with diodes than it does with one simple resistor. K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Take it in a minute, K6DPZ. Well, basically, diodes are so cheap, and they sometimes hard to find a low-value resistor with enough heat dissipation. And I've used the diodes, they work very well. SUN, go ahead and pick it up.
You got a call.
Hey, Dick, I was just thinking, could you take a, not potentiometer, but a rheostat, just hook it into the circuit, set it at one setting, and then just bring that setting down lower and lower. Now until the little light, John said that he's got a whole bunch of these lights he's using, cap one fails. Just bring it down until the one fails, and then just back it up a little bit, take an ohmmeter to find out what the resistance is, and then take a resistor and, of that, close to that number, and install it. Wouldn't that work?
It sure would, Paul. It would work like a charm. Now, I'm not sure exactly how many milliamps your light-emitting diode requires. Usually, they're a lot less than 50 milliamps. And it probably requires something like 1.5 volts in the forward direction. If you go through the calculation of 6.3 volts down to 1.5, it's around a 5-volt drop at 50 milliamps. The dropping resistor should be 100 ohms. 100 ohm resistor is very easy to acquire. And the 100 ohm resistor, let's see, it's going to be a 5 volt trap at 0.05 amps. In my example, that would be 0.05 Y. It's around a quarter of a watt of dissipation. So to find a resistor of the right value, approximately 100 ohms, in my example, is easy. The resistor gives you a lot more compliance. The voltage can go up and down a couple of volts, and you'll see almost no change in the brilliance of the light-emitting diode if you're doing it with a resistor. If you're doing it with diodes, just a little bit of increase in voltage and you're going to burn out the light-emitting diode, and a little bit of decrease in voltage and the light-emitting diode won't light at all, because the voltage drop across those diodes is a rather fixed number. So there's a difference in philosophy. Both work. I would rather do it with a resistor. Another thing worth doing is that if you want to take the simple approach of keeping using the 47 ohm pilot light. Let me drop.
And then one YDY.
YDY recognize. If you want to continue using the 47, number 47 pilot light, and if you want it to last a lot longer, you put a few ohms in series with it, because what really makes the pilot light burn out is the inrush current when you first turn it on. An incandescent bulb has a resistance that's less than 10 to 1 when it's cold versus hot. So the inrush current is huge. And that's what really damages the bulb. You put a very small series resistor, which makes a very little difference in the amount of brilliance. But all of a sudden, the bulb will last 10 times longer. YDY, go right ahead. KQRIW.
0.7 volts on silicon does the same thing.
Okay, Dick, good evening, and hi to you, Hal. The question I have is, why not use, a voltage supply, like a 7805 or something like that, to get down into the approximate voltage that you're looking for to drive the LED, and that way you don't have the inrush, the voltage difference problem if you have a small change in input.
Without a doubt, a three-terminal voltage regulator would do this very nicely. But that's a more expensive component, a more elaborate hookup. A simple dropping resistor does it very well. By the way, no matter how you regulate the voltage, if you're keeping the 47-volt light bulb, you still have the inrush of current when the bulb, when the filament is cold. It's got 1/10 of resistance when it's hot. So unless you had you could build a voltage-regulating circuit that has a gentle rise time to the voltage output versus time if you wanted to keep using the incandescent bulb. Nowadays, a lot of people really love light-emitting diodes that, on a good day, should last many thousands of hours. So having the right voltage drop so that you feed the light-emitting diode, I think, with a dropping resistor. Hal would rather do it with diodes. In the case of the 6.3 volt, if it happens to be AC, don't do it with a resistor. That's not bad. When you put current through a dropping resistor into a light-emitting diode in the wrong direction, it doesn't give you light, but it doesn't do any damage. The fact that it's AC versus DC, the right dropping resistor, it'll still light beautifully. In fact, you can buy particular light-emitting diodes where there's really a pair of diodes. Let me drop. There's a pair of diodes in the same package. One is white and one is red. One is white and one is green. And when you put positive voltage on there, the white one will light. When you put negative voltage, the green one will light. If you put AC on there, both of them will light. So putting the wrong polarity into a light-emitting diode by way of a dropping resistor, no problem as I see it. AC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
AC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I think if he got himself a wire-wound 1-watt resistor, the SAN-type resistors, he could hook that up and all three lamps could be on that same feed. I don't think he'd have any problem with that. It's a very old radio. I think it's from the 40s. And, you know, he's in love with the radio, but he's annoyed with the bulbs burning out. He's tried inductors and some resistors, but he found that the inductors were useless because even though when it comes on, that spike gets limited, it wasn't stopping the bulbs from going bad. I mean, he was changing them like every couple of weeks. Kind of crazy. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to one more, my last one.
More comment, K6DPZ.
Go ahead, Al.
Putting three LEDs in for the wall in series.
Another good suggestion. three of them in series with the right kind of a dropping resistor would work like a charm. Over to you, John.
Did you have something additional, Hal?
It'd be one-third the current, whereas he's running three of them in parallel, and the current would be three times as much.
Yeah, to rewire that circuit to put all the light-emitting diodes in series is very crafty, because they only have something in the order of 1.2, 1.5 volts drop. You look at the data sheet on your particular light-emitting diode, you'll find out what voltage or what current it needs, and after that, hooking them up is, with the right dropping resistor, in my suggestion, is a fairly simple Ohm's law. And when you're only going to be dissipating something like a quarter watt in that resistor, it doesn't necessarily have to be wire wound. A 1 watt carbon resistor would do the job very nicely, or a pair of quarter watt carbon resistors used in series or parallel to get the right resistance would also give you a half watt capability. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Well, at least he has a process to follow, and he should be able to do that without any trouble at all, and all he has to do is figure out how to mount them, and it'll be done. All right, I'll then drop going to my next one. All right, this gentleman is looking to purchase a network analyzer, spectrum analyzer, and he notices that some of them say scalar network analyzer. I'd like to know what that means, what can he do with it, and what can't he do with a scalar. And he's very confused about that word scalar in front of those descriptive terms of the units. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
A full-blown vector network analyzer literally measures vector voltages. What does that mean? If it's an AC voltage, like for instance 146 megacycles AC, an RF voltage that you send to your antenna, and if you're measuring the voltage and the current simultaneously with that instrumentation, it is a vector voltmeter or a vector network analyzer. So measuring voltage and phase simultaneously, that's vector. Turns out that measuring the phase accurately is a little bit difficult, and you can make a much cheaper version of a network analyzer by one that measures voltage magnitudes but does not measure phase. That's a so-called scalar. So a voltage measurement where you only know the magnitude but you don't know the phase angle, that's a scalar measurement as opposed to a vector measurement. With a scalar network analyzer, you can measure gain, insertion loss, and standing wave ratio. You can measure the amount of power going forward and the amount of power being reflected, and therefore the reverse voltage transfer ratio, so-called S11 scaling scattering parameter, or standing wave ratio, reflective coefficient, you can measure that. But because it does not measure phase, it will not give you a polar display of that. You will not get a Smith chart display. To make a Smith chart display requires measuring voltage and phase. Let me drop. So you've got to make a vector measurement to get a Smith chart display. Now, 90% of the time, when you and I are tuning up an antenna or an amplifier or whatever, to measure the forward and voltage ratio, the amount of voltage reflected by the input connector or the output connector, that gives you 90% of the data you need most of the time. But you're not going to get a Smith chart display out of that. The Smith chart display tells you not only are you getting a reflected voltage that is 10 dB down, that's roughly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but if you know the phase angle of the reflected voltage, because you're using a vector network analyzer, you now know, is the problem a resistive error too high or too low, or is it a reactive error? Is there some series inductance or series capacitance? In order to know the nature of the error of your input impedance, the Smith chart display. And that Smith chart display gives you that extra information that tells you directly how to go in there and retune it, so to speak. By way of a scalar network analyzer, you can still find out which direction is the error, but now you've got to do a bunch of experiments. You put in a small inductor and see if it gets better. You put in a small capacitor, see if it gets better. You raise the resistance or lower the resistance and see if it gets better. So indirectly, you get the same information, but it takes you a lot more steps. So Scalar network analyzers in general are, let me pick a number, half the price of a vector network analyzer. You get a lot for the money out of it, but occasionally it'll give you a little bit of grief because you really wanted a Smith chart display. KC2 WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Okay. Yeah, that about covers that. They are very convenient, and they do work well, but there's not enough information for me. I have one of them, and I would never buy another scalar device. Not enough information, right? Okay, that's it from the mailbag, Dick, and we'll go over to Paul with the space report and see what's happening out there in the dark spots. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. And Paul, let's see now, the last we heard is there was a, he talked about this 12-mile-high experiment that is one step in the direction of a space elevator, this numerically operated, numerically inflated 12-mile-high structure, building-like structure, that was just issued a patent recently, and it was on a number of the technical websites. Somehow I doubt that that's actually going to actually be built. I'm also rather doubtful that the space elevator will actually ever be built, because for it to survive lightning strikes, tornadoes, hurricanes, aircraft strikes, and whatever, there's an awful lot of ways that it can be damaged. There's an awful lot of ways that it can fail. It's a very complicated and expensive installation. Once you've got it installed, oh boy, you've got a huge advantage for every pound you wanted to put in space is now a small fraction of the cost to do that. But it's a darn vulnerable. I mean, to have a piece of cable sitting 22,000 miles high, connected to the Earth and going out there into space, and hoping nothing comes along and hits it, satellite, meteorite, comet, asteroid, airplane, lightning bolt, hurricane, tornado, high wind, another ship going to the to strike the ship that's the anchor out in the ocean. It's not many vulnerabilities it has, and also to try to generate a cable that can suspend its own weight for 22,000 miles. Oh boy, is that an engineering problem. Graphite reinforced materials, if you can make the individual strands of the graphite material long enough, you come close to having the right strength to weight ratio. But so easily can have a failure mechanism. I mean, if a couple of those fibers start coming apart in the middle of your cable, and if it took you $1 billion to install that cable, and all of a sudden the whole thing comes crashing down, I guarantee that's going to create some strong, salty language for the guy who owns that installation. He goes,
Wyo?
Mr. Wyo, go ahead, KQLIW.
What were your numbers about how long or how high this would be? I believe you said 22,000 miles. My understanding, it would only be about 20 miles high.
The patent that was just issued is for a proof of performance structure 12 miles high. The full space elevator would have to be considerably longer than 22,300 miles. 22,300 just gets you up to synchronous orbit. The actual heavy weight that you hang at the far end has got to be a good number of miles beyond that for the whole thing to work as a true space elevator. So this was a proof of performance concept patent issued for a 12-mile high pneumatically inflated structure. K2YO, Bernie. You got it, Bernie.
Gotcha. My understanding is what they were targeting was effectively an elevator or a temporary structure that they could put up, maybe land a vehicle or send a vehicle off, and save the launch need to get that first 12 miles up. You know, to go from zero to whatever. To go from zero to escape velocity. That the idea that that would go into low orbit, and then it was much less costly to go from low orbit to high orbit. But I'm not near as knowledgeable as this as young Paul are. So I was just curious about the discrepancy of the numbers.
Question, Dick.
You got it, John.
thing comes to mind, if they're going to use a ship for anchor, let's say they put it out in the Pacific somewhere and you have 50-foot ground swells, how are they going to compensate? Just think about the stress on that cable. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, when it was, when the anchor was going to be a ship out to sea, the bottom of the ship was going to be a kind of a pulley that reels in and pays out the cable as the ship rises and falls. So it takes a pretty elaborate mechanism. Yes, you don't want to be towing on 22,000 miles of cable that's got a 10-ton weight at the far end of it, so to speak. You don't want to be towing on it because the sea is going up and down. So there's got to be an accommodating structure on that ship. On top of that, the ship has got to have a whole lot of knowledge as to where the airplanes are, where the hurricanes are, and so on. The ship has to move to the right location at the right time in order to avoid these obstacles. Some of those obstacles are going to be other spacecraft that are in orbit around the Earth. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, so they're going to have some kind of a reel to compensate for that. But if you look at the keel length time of rise and fall, it goes pretty quick in some of those ground swells. To have something play out that kind of cable, I mean, I know they did it with the Atlantic cable when they went through some bad weather, but that's going to be fun to see. Thank you, Dick. Back to you. KC2WGB.
Even though the cable of a true space elevator is going to be made out of very stiff material, something like graphite reinforced, any material that's long enough, you think it's a stiff material, it really is a spring. In the case of my 100-foot high Rhone 55 tower, where some of those upper guy wires go 140 feet off to one side, and they got 3,000 pounds of force on them, if I'm at the top of the tower and I push my body toward the tower and away from the tower cyclically, I can stretch those cables. In other words, I can feel the fact that the cable with 3,000 pounds of stretch on it, quarter-inch guy wire, 6M cable, it really is a spring when it's 140 feet long. I'm only moving it a few inches, but I am stretching it. And so when you get a cable 22,000 miles, that's one very large spring. I'm beginning to think that the stretchiness of that much cable, no matter what it's made out of, will accommodate the fact that the ship is going up and down. You might not even have to reel that in and reel it out. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
We got a question in 2MB.
Well, I can understand that, Dick, but also you're right in a way, because with the wind conditions, there's going to be a bow in that cable. It's not going to go straight up. So maybe just pulling the bow with a little more tension to straighten it more vertical than in an arc, maybe that'll also help compensate. Okay, pick up Barry, KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, wait for the beeps and you got it, Barry.
Okay, now assuming they're putting this on the equator, how far off the equator can they put it and it would still work? And is there any mathematical way to put this at the poles?
At the poles, the answer is absolutely no. It is the circulation, it is the rotation of the Earth that by centrifugal force swings your counterweight out there. The counterweight is beyond 22,000 miles. The counterweight is above synchronous orbit altitude. And as the Earth rotates once every 24 hours, it's swinging that weight. That weight creates tension that supports the rest of the guy wire, the rest of the wire all the way down to the ground. You could mount it above or below the equator, and it would go straight out. In other words, in all cases, it will swing itself straight out from the axis of the Earth. You draw a straight line between North Pole and South Pole of the Earth, assuming that's what the Earth rotates on, and this thing will always swing at right angles to that. And so as you go higher and higher in latitude, now need a longer and longer piece of cable. And as you go to the limit, you need an extra 4,000 miles of cable, because that's the radius of the Earth. So there's a lot of disadvantages of going above the equator, a whole lot. Are you starting to get a picture of that one, Barry? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Yeah, I certainly can. I was just wondering if there was something I didn't know, which unfortunately I didn't, because I would have liked to think that there might be a way to put this at the poles. Just a thought. Okay, back to you, Dave.
A slightly similar question that people sometimes ask is, I'd like to have a geosynchronous satellite, geostationary satellite that sits at one fixed point in the sky, so that my ground station doesn't have to be swishing back and forth in latitude, in the altitude, and azimuth, and elevation. I can just fix it, tie it down to one spot. And so all of the geostationary satellites are directly over the equator, one-dimensional real estate. It's a bunch of beads along a string out there, 22,300 miles. Lots of people will say, why can't I put a geostationary satellite right over New York City? And the problem is New York City is 41 degrees almost above the equator. And there's no way you can put a geosynchronous satellite there, because as far as the satellite is concerned, it's going around the center of mass of the Earth. The fact that you and I have got some latitude and longitude lines, we've got something we call the equator, it doesn't give a damn. It knows it's going around this spherical object called Earth that has a center of mass somewhere in the exact center of the Earth. That's what it thinks it's going around. So by creating an inclination of orbit, you can make it pass over New York City once every 24 hours, but it's now an inclined orbit is the only way you can get there. Only over the equator can you create geostationary. You can make a geosynchronous of New York City, where it creates this great big figure eight pattern, 40 degrees up and 40 degrees down in latitude every 24 hours, and it passes over the New York City point once every day, but you can't make it hang there. You come close with the so-called Russian Molinya orbit, which is a highly elliptical orbit at just the right inclination of orbit, something like 67 degrees, such that it spends a whole lot of time over the Soviet Union. Anybody have any further comments or questions on this, K2RIW?
Yeah. Are there any places on Earth where they can have their satellite, the long string thing, you know, but it would come down over land instead of over water?
There's lots and lots of places. In the case of the space elevator, it doesn't necessarily have to be over the equator, because that space elevator, the string itself, so to speak, the cable, is going to be always at right angles to the Earth's rotational axis, that straight line between the North Pole and South Pole. It'll always be at right angles to that. You can mount it anywhere you want. You could put it over Florida if that's what you want, Barry. Go ahead.
No, we can't. Just listening to what you're saying, something doesn't sound right about that. That would have to be a movable string, and it would have to be moving through the atmosphere. No, that doesn't sound right. But I'm thinking is, can you put it, in other words, can you have the space string going up to a place where it wouldn't be starting from water? They're always bringing this thing down from to a water location on the ground, because that's convenient. That's where the equator, most of the equator is. But there are plenty of places, I think, where you have the equator, but it's over land, not over water, which would make it a little easier. You wouldn't have to put this thing on a ship, you know?
When it comes to a satellite in geostationary orbit, it has no choice but to be directly over the equator. When it comes to a space elevator that comes down to the surface of the Earth, there is no magic location. The equator is one nice location. I can go 35 degrees above the equator. It's called Florida. I could mount a space elevator tether point down on the surface of Florida, right at the Kennedy Space Center, if they would allow me to do it. And it would go straight out from Florida at right angles to the Earth's axis, out to its counterweight. So the object is not in orbit. The object is a tethered object out there. The counterweight is a tethered object, tethered by the cable going down to the ground. There, it's not a geostationary orbit per se. You're continuously tugging on it to make it go in a particular path that you care about. Are you starting to get that picture, Larry? N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW.
But you can't do it over the poles. That you can't do.
And the reason for that is because when I've got a ball on the end of a string, and I'm moving my hand in a cyclic manner so that the ball will go around in circles. I have to move my hand in a circular manner a certain distance to couple energy into that swinging system. Okay? When the bottom tether of a space elevator is at the equator is 4,000 miles above the axis of rotation of the Earth, so therefore you could say I am moving my hand, so to speak, 4,000 miles in a circle. In the case of the North Pole or the South Pole, the distance you're moving your hand goes to zero. You're no longer coupling energy into it. It will no longer follow you, so to speak. It will no longer swing. You could set it up where it's tethered to the pole. The string is going to come off the pole at right angles to the polar axis. It's going to come off parallel to the ground, a very inconvenient way. And as long as you give the counterweight out there enough energy, it will continue to swing. That's the good news. But that whole length of cable is now being dragged through the Earth's atmosphere, which is moving at some other rate. That's going to be creating a curve in the cable. In general, it's going to be dampening your action, and pretty soon your satellite is no longer moving at the right rate. Are you starting to get that picture, Barry? N2 Moon Bounce, K2LAW.
Yes, I certainly do. So there's a certain amount of drag because you're... Yeah, I got it. I do understand that. So, how far can you go from the equator towards the pole before this is no longer practical?
I can answer that in a funny way. With today's technology, even in the most desirable location at the equator, right now it is not practical. I can't make a cable strong enough in strength-to-weight ratio. I mean, in the case of the Freedom Tower, 1,700 feet tall, you'd like to believe there was one cable 1,700 feet long and you got one express elevator going from the ground to the top of that building. Absolutely not. You haven't got a cable that's strong enough to do that. So if you can't even go 1,700 feet, and we'd like to go 22,300 miles, oh boy. The best materials we can think of, graphite reinforced, if you can make the strands long enough, can just barely do it as I see it. So space elevator is a very nice concept on paper. It is my belief, Barry, that your grandchildren are probably not going to see one of those in operation. N2MB, wait for the beeps, K2LAW.
And I do dream about it. Good boy, would it be a nice idea. Anyway, back to you, N2MB, Rocky Way Beach.
Quick question, Dick.
Yeah, one more thing I'm going to add to this. As you make that counterweight further and further away, higher than 22,300 miles, it's now giving you more and more tension on the cable. If you made it, let me pick a number, 40,000 miles long. Now, launching an object on that cable, 40,000 miles of altitude, with a considerable amount of excess velocity, the object that you launch out there might even already be very close to Earth escape velocity. So you don't even have to give your spacecraft extra velocity as well as altitude. It all comes simultaneously. As you make that space elevator longer and longer, eventually you're launching it at higher and higher speeds because the Earth turns at a very fixed rate. You make that cable long enough, and pretty soon the end of the cable is almost moving at the speed of light, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2LAW, go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. Well, now that we have this thing out in space and it's going to have some kind of drag, what kind of propulsion system do they have to keep it up at the same speed, to keep it equal? Otherwise, that thing's going to wrap around the Earth like a fishing reel. What prevents that?
Okay. When you and I have a ball on the end of a string and we swing it above our head, movement of your hand couples energy into that system and it keeps on swinging. You move your hand fast enough and you can make it swing super fast. The fact that there is a moment off between the Earth axis and the point of attachment where the cable comes down to the Earth, and if you did it at the equator, that moment arm is 4,000 miles long, and that moment arm moves once 360 degrees every 24 hours. That's coupling energy into the system. And so the system, once it's up and running, energy you're coupling into it by the Earth's rotation creates continuous tension, and it'll stay up with you. There'll be a little bit of a curve to it, it'll have a little bit of a lagging curve out to that counterweight, but it'll keep right on moving. It's not going to roll up like a fishing string there once you establish it, John. Go ahead. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, good enough. It seems like I don't think I'm going to see it. You and I don't have a chance. All right, let's go over to Paul and see what he's got.
Yeah, we got to wait until they develop a lot better materials, which is possible. And so,
spider webs.
Maybe. WS2N. What's been happening in space this week, John? I mean, Paul, KQLIW.
Okay, space elevator is a fascinating topic. But, we're not going to see it. I'm hoping to see eventually a Mars landing. I got my fingers crossed for that, never mind a space elevator. And, in fact, there was a debate between Lance Stroop, he's the guy that's running the Mars One group, and some students from MIT, and they were discussing the possibilities of what this guy wants to do with Mars One and send people to Mars on a one-way trip. A lot of people think what this guy's trying to do, including me, is never going to happen. And these people have some of the opinions that we had on the net. You know, there's not enough money. This guy's looking at, he's hoping to raise millions of dollars when you need billions of dollars. He's thinking he can do it on $6 billion, and MIT told them just to send people to the moon. Of course, $30 billion back then, and a little over $100 billion in today's money to do exactly what they did back then. And he says, well, we're just sending him one way, you know. So it's going to be a long time before that. He's using different groups. He employed Paragon Space Enterprise to work on life support systems. And, you know, that's a reputable company, Paragon, he's using their studies as a defense, saying that, you know, we have the capability now to do it, you know, with food, water, but keep human beings alive for not only 6 to 8 months to get there, but at least a year or so on the Martian surface. And plus, in his case, not bringing people back, just sending more people every 2 years or every 27 months. And to use people from Paragon, like Jane Pointer, and her husband, Tabor, his name is, they were the people that were on Biosphere 2, Tabor McCollum, Jane Pointer, were two of the main people eight people that were on Biosphere 2 back in the early 90s that spent 2 years inside of this biosphere in Arizona trying to survive in an enclosed system, which is over 3 acres of land, and they could barely do it. They had problems. They eventually brought some oxygen in, and, you know, to think you're going to duplicate this process and go all the way to Mars and land there. Just because these people did this, but, you know, don't use their studies and everything to think that you're going to duplicate that. It's a problem. So, you know, as you can tell, I'm not a big Mars One fan. Especially in this time frame. You know, he thinks he's going to have orbital spacecraft. He's going to have his own rovers. He's going to have, people landing by 2027. It's not going to happen. We'll get there sooner or later, but this guy's not going to do it. The reason he's doing it, he's coming up with these comments. He tries to stay in the news media. He's trying to get billionaires on board. He thinks that, you know, all he needs is 1 or 2 billionaires to start funding his project. And he thinks everything's going to take off. I don't think there's too many billionaires that are going to support his project. He's using Elon Musk and Benzo of Amazon to think that, these guys are building their own rocket ships. Elon Musk would
Falcon 9.
Paul, let me ask you a question. In the case of Biosphere, which I think was a couple of acres of property with plants and people inside, and the thing was supposed to be self-sustaining.